Well, hello and welcome to the second part of our series on Asian American and African American relations, co-hosted by the Asian American Christian Collaborative and Be the Bridge, entitled Interconnected: Confronting Racial Prejudice Between Asian American and African American Communities. My name is Michelle Reyes and I am the Vice President of the AACC. The first installment of this series discussed the troubled histories between Asian American and African Americans in the United States. And now for the second installment, we turn to assessing and analyzing racial prejudices from a biblical perspective. In other words, now that we are more attuned to the pains and wounds between our communities, how do we identify the roots of our racial prejudices toward each other, call it out for the sin that it is, and work to deconstruct it in our lives? Because as Christians, we have to turn to the Bible on this matter. The Bible is God's words to us, God's revelation of his will, his plan and purposes for all creation. And ultimately, the Bible is our source of truth. It tells us why we were made and how we are to flourish as human beings with one another under God's rule and reign. And in regard to humanity, the Bible makes clear that every person is made in God's image. Each human being of every ethnicity is stamped with the Imago Dei. And for this reason alone, is deserving of respect, honor, dignity, and love. In the words of John Calvin, the 16th century French reformer, when looking for motivation to love others, he says, quote, "Look to the image of God in them, an image which covering and obliterating their faults should by its beauty and dignity allure us to love and embrace them." Mm. Now, as the biblical narrative continues, we see the ways that sin corrupts every human, fracturing our vertical relationship with God and our horizontal relationships with one another, including cross-culturally. It's because of sin that Asian Americans look down on African Americans and tell their children things like don't marry into the Black community. Mm. It's because of sin that African Americans make fun of Asians and Asian Americans. It's because of sin that we have internalized a whole host of animosity and hostility against one another, which manifests in the ways that we see, treat, and talk about the other. But the Bible demands that we treat each other as image bearers of God. And that's our trajectory for today's discussion. We're going to map out terms. We're going to look to the Bible to find a clear heading and exploration of racial prejudice. And we're going to conclude by considering practical ways to remove the sin of racial prejudice from our own lives. Mm-hmm. I have the privilege of hosting this conversation with Akemene Uwan, Jeff Leo, Issa McCulley, and Micah Edmondson. Now, Akemene Uwan is a public theologian and co-host of Truth's Table podcast. She received her Master of Divinity degree from Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia. In 2018, Christianity Today named her among 10 new or lesser known female theologians worth knowing. Her writings have been published in the Washington Post, Huffington Post Black Voices, and her insights have been quoted by CNN, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the New Yorker. In addition to her writings, Akemene's voice has been sampled on Lecrae's album, All Things Work Together, and Show Baraka's The Narrative. You can follow her on Twitter at @Sista_theology and Instagram at @SistaTheology. Reverend Issa McCulley serves as Assistant Professor of New Testament at Wheaton College in Wheaton, Illinois. He's also the director of the Next Generation Initiative for the Anglican Church in North America, a province-wide undertaking committed to raising up and training the next generation of Anglican clergy and lay leadership. He is a published author with his articles appearing in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and Christianity Today. His first book entitled Sharing in the Son's Inheritance was published by T.N.T. Clark in 2019. And his second book, Reading While Black, African-American Biblical Interpretation as an Exercise in Hope, will be published by IVP Academic in November 2020. And I cannot wait for that. Dr. Jeff Liu is one of our anti-racism resource specialists at AACC. He also serves on staff with InterVarsity Christian Fellowship as their Director of Theological Formation. He has worked as a pastor, university chaplain, and adjunct professor. He earned his PhD from Fuller Theological Seminary, where he studied the intersection of race and theology. Jeff has contributed chapters to books on Asian American Christianity and ethics in pastoral ministry. Jeff lives in Southern California with his wife, Lisa, and their two children. And last but not least, Micah Edmondson is a Presbyterian minister and has a PhD in systematic theology from Calvin Seminary. He is a native of Nashville, Tennessee, and is the author of The Power of Unearned Suffering, a book about MLK's theology of suffering. Thank you guys all for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Well, let's just dive in here. And I want to start by defining some terms. And I want to go to Akemeni. Akemeni, can you tell us how do we define ethnicity? How is this different from race? And where do we see these ideas mapped out in scripture? I know that's a three-part question, but I just want to talk to you. We'll start easy.
I got it. Well, why don't I start about with race and then go into ethnicity and then go into the scriptures. So race is a social construct that's organized around strife, difference. It's based on stratification. And just to put it simply, with Black people on bottom, right, and white people on top, you know, that within the framework of what race is, not in reality, like, you know, at least according to God, I should say. So race is created, and it's man-made, and it is something. I would go as far as to say it's not something that will be redeemed, right? Because the roots of race produce racism, and which is obviously, you know, the prejudice and the attitudes and the difference that comes in a racist society, which we live in the U.S., you know, where power is exerted over the marginalized. So those in power, this would be the white people, right? They're the majorities. They control of the systems, institutions, you know, that we even study that, they have the power to actually be racist. But us here on this panel, I'm sorry, at this table, but on this panel, actually technically cannot actually be racist. Now, we can be prejudiced, right, and have different misjudgments and attitudes, negative attitudes toward one another. We can be demeaning to one another, you know, so having these prejudices and having bigotry, repeating stereotypes that are dehumanizing, we can do those things. So we can be prejudiced, we can be bigoted, but we can't be racist because we do not have the power, technically we do not have the power to actually oppress in a systematic way. Now, with regard to ethnicity is where there's a common group of people, right, that have a shared heritage, shared language, shared religion, I'd even say shared culture, among many things. And so ethnicity, however, we do see that in the Bible. And that is something that we will retain because it's good. It's God ordained. You see it in the scriptures, ethnicity. You see Paul talk about, you know, I'm a Hebrew of Hebrews, right? He's talking about his ethnicity. Matthew, the genealogy, right, is showing us Jesus's ethnic heritage, which mattered, right, because he's the Son of God, and he was the greater David. In order for him to secure our inheritance, he had to be, you know, have to have that Jewish heritage. So that matters, and those things matter. And then even if you want to go further on into Revelation, where we see this beautiful picture of what awaits us, right, when we are before the throne of God. Revelation 7:9 talks about how, you know, I saw before the throne people of every tribe, tongue, and nation gathered at the throne. So that again talks about, you know, tongue, language. It's talking again about ethnicity. And so we see that's something that we will carry forth even when we are called home from this place and we're in that great new city. So that's what I would say. Those are the distinctions I would make about race and ethnicity, and even just a, you know, some little examples of where we see it in the biblical text.
That's so good. Esau, did you want to add something to that?
A couple of things. I might want to add that, like, when we talk about, like, especially race in the United States, it may seem obvious to us, like, who's white, who's Asian, and who's Black. Right. But this is actually codified in law, right? If you look through the history of the United States, because if you had the status of white, you're able to be nationalized. And so I know there are court cases where both Korean and Chinese Americans sued to be put into the category of white, to be separate from the category of Black, because if you got the category of white, then you got certain advantages. And time and time again, the United States said, no, if you're Korean, if you're Indian, if you're Chinese, you don't qualify as white. Therefore, these prejudices that are inscribed in law remain in place. So we talk about racial categories, we think of them as being intuitive and not having any real historical weight. But what I want to say is that in the United States, white was a legal term that conveyed economic benefits. And because of that, it created, like Kimberly said, this hierarchy. And so I know that sometimes we talk about saying, well, I'm white, I'm Asian, I'm black, as if that didn't, in the United States context, carry with it some economic reality. And even the aspiration of being included in the category of white wasn't because Asian Americans had a if I can speak, if this is accurate, correct me if I'm incorrect, it wasn't like a sense of self-hatred. It was a sense, or even necessarily inherent hatred of black people. It was like, in the United States, if you're in the category of black, you can be excluded. Therefore, I want to be with the dominant group. And so that creates this this aspirational dynamic that I think is still with us today. And so the eschatological elimination of race is true, because once, you know, hierarchy and supremacy is overcome, then we will all be equal. But there is no eschatological erasure of ethnicity, because God calls it good. And as Kimberly said, it's eschatological. So I do think it's important to both mark what our culture has done, like legally, not just culturally, legally as it relates to race, and separate that from what the Bible says eschatologically about ethnicity.
I'd like to, if I could, just kind of piggyback off a little bit of what Esau and Akimini both said. I think the issue of racism, what we might think of it in terms of what I would call ethnocentrism, or kind of ethnic bias that has power, we see that propping up very early on in Scripture. You think, for instance, of the Joseph story, right? So you have Joseph who is brought down into Egypt and sold into slavery, and very soon into that experience, he experiences what we might call ethnocentrism, in which he's suspected, and he is he's essentially set up by Potiphar's wife, who actually appeals to his ethnicity in order to set him up, in order to make him out to be, Potiphar's wife was the one who wanted to, have this inappropriate relationship with Joseph, and Joseph resisted it. And then Potiphar's wife, claims that Joseph was the perpetrator, and she's able to sell this story because she appeals to his ethnicity, that he's a Hebrew. And because of the racial prejudices, the ethnocentrism within that society, the Egyptian society at the time, Joseph is suspected, and he doesn't get a fair hearing. The same thing crops up again when you see Joseph now. Goes down into the pit. He's brought out of the pit. He's elevated as the second in command over Egypt, and then his brothers come, and we know that whole story about his brothers coming. But at one point, his brothers come, and they don't know who he is. And there's this kind of side comment that that at that time it was an abomination for Egyptians to eat with Hebrews, And so you see it cropping up again. And so just throughout that story, you see this sense of the dominant, this kind of widespread view that the native peoples of that land, the native ethnic peoples of that land and that society, consider themselves to be superior to folks who are outside of that society. Joseph's brothers come to settle the land later on, and it's said again before Pharaoh shepherds are like an abomination to the Egyptians, and so the the Hebrews have to settle the land of Goshen precisely because the Egyptians at that time considered them as ethnic peoples to be an abomination, and their customs and their culture was considered to be an abomination. And you can look back at Genesis chapter 10, which is the Table of Nations, even before that. And it really lays out how all of these nations come from Noah and his son and his children, his sons. And the part of the kind of the revelation of that is that all humans come from one family, which really would have pushed back against the dominant belief at that time. In that day, people felt as though they were superior, that their people came from the gods, and that they were inherently superior than other peoples. And so to have a story, a revelation that says, hey, actually everyone comes from this common stock, that really, really pushed back against the dominant view of that day. This is exactly the way in which Paul uses this story on Mars Hill, which he says all people come from one blood or from one family. So the belief of ethnocentrism and the gospel push back against it it goes very deep into the Bible. It goes all the way to Genesis.
I would say there's a couple of more places where you see this in the Bible, two of which are interesting, especially when you see them as gendered. The issue of the Hebrew midwives, where they turn a racial stereotype upside down, is like, well, why? Because you know the command was to kill these babies before they were born, but the excuse was like, well, these Hebrew women are just so, they're different than us, so they're so vigorous they can just like pop the babies out. And with this is an example of kind of the use of a racial bias to kind of survive under oppression. The other one I think is often misinterpreted, possibly because of the history of racism in the United States, is the controversy over Moses' wife. And we tend to think of it as the controversy over Moses' wife is because the other Jewish people didn't want this Egyptian woman who was lower, because they want to associate Egyptians with Black people and make us low. But in actuality, what we think is the issue with Moses' wife being Egyptian is actually the fact that she was higher class. And that some of the pushback on Moses is that Moses was being uppity because he had this Egyptian woman. Because you gotta think about it, the Hebrew people were the lower class people in this context. And so you see kind of the internalized sense of potential inferiority in which, what is Moses doing with this high class woman? And so you see all of the places where not just there is kind of an external racism, you see some internalized insecurity playing itself out in the Bible too. So you see both external racism and internalized discomfort with their own identity. And so I think that the Bible does in different places deal with these racial dynamics that we see today.
Yeah, there's so much going on there in the way we can take a look at biblical passages and consider the dynamics of race and ethnicity there. And I think people hesitate to do that, in part because of what Kemeny mentioned at the beginning, this idea that race is a social construct. They tend to think, or a lot of people tend to think, that because that's the case, that it's therefore not real. And they're looking for a kind of ontology, a kind of reality about a concept. And they think because race is man-made, it must be a kind of fabrication. And we're looking for something that has some real media ontology to it, some real reality to it. And we turn to the Bible for that, and they don't see the word in there, even though it is in there. So I want to highlight a couple of things and boost a lot of what's already been said, but also take it in a different direction. You know, the words ethnos and genos, these are the words that we translate as ethnicity, and some, you know, 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 9, some translations will treat genos as race, as in genos eklepton, chosen race. And patristic sources will take that phrase and run with it a little bit, and what emerges from early church fathers' theological work is what some folks will call racial reasoning, but they're launching directly from that word genos, which, you know, the Greek translations of the Old Testament have that everywhere from Genesis 1 on. The word is there, and it designates a kind of peoplehood, but it would be dangerous, probably a big mistake, to map what we consider to be race today and the way it works onto what genos means in the Old Testament and New Testament. The way race works right now is very much what Akemeni described, that it's privilege plus power equals racism. That definition from Patricia Beidall in the 1970s was really helpful in identifying some of the dynamics that we don't want to read back onto the biblical text. But for us to treat peoplehood, which, you know, if there were a kind of a Venn diagram between race and ethnicity, both of these concepts, even in the current time, and including back then, if you look at, for example, Love Seacrest's really important work on ethnos and genos, if you look at those, the Venn diagram seems to overlap in the sense of peoplehood, which causes us to behave in certain ways to each other. So for folks to say, like, is race even in the Bible? Why should we address it if it's not there? The first answer is, we have to pay attention to it because race is real in its effects today. And Christian faithfulness has everything to do with the effects of race and racism in the world. Secondly, the charge that it's anachronistic to read it onto the Bible, my reply to that is, well, individualistic readings are anachronistic to the Bible, but Western readers have focused on individualistic interpretation for decades, and we're not any better for it. So if you want to charge anachronism, we want to be really technical and careful. And that's where some of us, I'm so glad that there's so many scholars here on this episode, because we have work to do to help folks understand how exactly are we reading into the New Testament and the Old Testament. It's important to call some of these things out.
Yeah, that's so good. Thank you guys all so much for just mapping that out. And Jeff, your point about, oftentimes Christians, conservative Christians, are hesitant to talk about matters related to race. There is that argument that, race isn't in the Bible, so we don't need to address it. But then, on the other side of the coin is that we have become very aware to the ways in which American Christianity has perpetuated racial ideologies throughout our country's history. And this brings us back to the issue of Asian Americans and African Americans. And Micah, I wanted to turn this question to you, is could you speak more into that about the ways in which American Christianity has perpetuated racial ideologies, and perhaps because of this ignorance or this sort of anemic theological understanding of race in scripture, and what that's done to Asian American and African American relations. I'm sorry, all of my questions are like three parts.
That's all right. That's a great question. Thank you for that question. That's a tremendous question. So race has, from the very beginning, even before this country was thought of itself as the United States, race was a very central part of what it meant to be, to think of oneself as a Christian. And I say that because Rebecca Getz, in a really important work of the Baptism of Early Virginia, really talks about early theologies of baptism in colonial Virginia. And she talks about how the planters, the colonial planters, would not baptize enslaved Africans and indigenous people, because they knew that once they did, it would change the social relation between these peoples. And so what they did was they just refused them baptism, and they actually came up with a belief to sort of justify this practice called hereditary heathenism, in which they essentially asserted that indigenous and African peoples could not be Christianized, that these people actually were perpetual pagans, that they could not come to faith in Christ and live a Christian life. And so they would not baptize these folks. And so from the very beginning here, what we see is we see a kind of cultural legalism in which whiteness is a kind of currency for acceptance with God, and a currency for membership within the church, right? And I believe that kind of cultural legalism has persisted throughout the generations in one form or the other. And so that really sets up a very difficult dynamic in which people are either encouraged to assimilate into whiteness with a view toward coming closer to God, right? Or if you find yourself as a hereditary heathen, as a person that's on the bottom of that socioeconomic and racial hierarchy, you can't come into it. Okay, you're perpetually outside. Okay, and so I think that is a way in which American Christianity from the very beginning has set up and reinforced some very ugly dynamics in our society, and especially within the context of the church. And I mean, you fast forward all the way up until civil rights movement, right? You still had churches whose roles were segregated, right, based upon race. And that's that same principle of hereditary heathenism at work. And whether it's stated formally or it is worked out informally and functionally, that principle is the same. I mean, a lot of folks may not necessarily say you aren't welcomed unless you're one of us, but the way this works out practically is that unless you sing like us, unless you, unless you culturally assimilate to the way in which we do worship, you're not really welcomed here. We're not really gonna welcome you into full membership. You're gonna kind of always be marginalized. And that again is that kind of cultural legalism at play. So I think that's one of the main ways in which American Christianity has set up this dynamic.
I have to hop right on that, because I think this idea of hereditary, if you'll indulge me for a second, the whole thing about viruses and the way they work and what RNA and DNA does, I want to raise the question about whether American Christianity's theology is infected right at the root, at the DNA level. Because to take it even further back from before the American experiment, Willie Jennings traces the kind of response to black bodies during the genesis of enslavement, that the rationale was necessarily a theological rationale. The hope was that maybe we can Christianize a soul, and that would justify what God is doing in this transnational migration that they called slavery. Mm-hmm. It's a kind of twisted theological logic that migrated to the United States, which says to us that the most important thing that we can do is Christianize someone. And to place that too high on the shelf for black and brown bodies, that's one move that can be made. The other move that can be made is, we'll go to Africa, we'll go to China to do mission work, but we won't go across the street. And that kind of view of Christianization that is racialized and problematized, I think that's at the very DNA level of American Christianity. So has American Christianity complicated how we do race in the United States? Absolutely. It's in the way we do mission and evangelism, and that's something we have to scrutinize.
Can I say something about that? I want to say that this is, and this is the important part, it's pre-exegetical. What I mean is, Micah touched on it and Jeff touched on it, is that Christians knew that, okay, if you baptize someone and bring them into the church, then that implies an equality. Therefore, we need to create a different anthropology and a different account of black persons to justify what we do. And then that anthropology is read unto biblical text. What I want to say is that, like, nobody thought that 1 Timothy chapter 6 applied to them as Christians, but it applies to black people because black people had a different anthropology. And the anthropology was not read out of Paul. It was created, and then Paul was used to justify it. The other thing I want to say about that is that, and I said this like in an article that I wrote last week, that African-American Christians rescued Christian anthropology. And when I said that, it's actually true, is that we basically reconstructed a Christian anthropology based upon biblical foundations, where we said, no, your account of personhood does not sufficiently account for Genesis 1:26-28, that we're all image bearers. And so, no, black Christians were not the first people to talk about the Imago Dei. We weren't. That was just in the Bible. But we did bring the question of the Imago Dei into conversation with the enslavement of black people and said, the Bible that you've handed to us speaks against our oppression. And so when I talk about like American Christian anthropology, the question I want to say is, what America are you talking about? Because the African American Christian tradition, if I've read it right, reconstructs Christian anthropology. And what you have, and I've said this 1,000 times, the civil rights movement is nothing other than like a public theological argument on the nature of the Imago Dei, in which black Christians said the Imago Dei means this for us, and a significant portion of the white church said, no, it doesn't, and we won the argument. And so I want to say that American American Christian anthropology, in so much that it is biblical, arises from African-American theological reflection as a pushback against a dominant culture. And so I think that you're correct to say that like American Christianity has significant theological flaws at its founding, but those flaws, I want to say, are really, really rooted in greed and economics, and it's pre-exegetical. And the other thing I want to say, and it fell, like, once the people who are oppressed got a hold to these texts and pushed back on it. There's not a legitimate question as to who's reading those biblical texts correctly as we look back from history. And so it's actually, to my mind, a historical embarrassment that we actually managed to do this as Christians. So it's not really a disagreement. It's to put what we're talking about in the context of historical development and how at least one ethnic minority group pushed back on it. And I think that's an important legacy that is a part of American Christianity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's just a good point that you raised, Esau. I mean, you made a lot of good points, but I think understanding that when we say American Christianity, okay, which Americans? Because oftentimes we default to white, right? Because they have the most power, right? They have the political power and, you know, all those, that jazz. But when you come down to it, you look at Christians of color, particularly if you're looking at the Black church, right? Because the Black church has the receipt with regard to justice, the civil rights movement. You're talking about a people that has always been the conscience of this nation. And I'd also say the conscience of what American Christianity is, right? And so we've always been the prophets, if you will, of the nation. And that's obviously by God's grace, but also through the oppression that we've experienced. But I think it is important for us to also define what do we mean when we say American, and also broaden that when we're saying, because sometimes we can tend to speak generally when we say American Christianity, well, who's though, you know? So just wanted to affirm what Esau was saying there too.
I would like to add this. You know, eventually the colonial planters did baptize enslaved Africans and indigenous people. But what they did was very insidious. What they did was they essentially changed and re-engineered their doctrine of baptism so that it stripped away all social implications of baptism, right? And so, because what they found was when they would baptize enslaved Africans, the enslaved Africans would assume that now they were free by virtue of their baptism. That now, if I'm baptized, what that means is that we have a fundamentally different social relation. And so, in fact, the Virginia legislature actually had to make a pronouncement to say that baptism did not change a person's social relation, right? Because the assumption amongst the enslaved was that it would. And I think that gave us a form of Christianity, okay, that actually what became devoid of that kind of ethical heritage, that kind of the ethical claim of baptism, right? And it's interesting because it's almost like the Virginia planters kind of knew what baptism would mean, and they were so afraid of it, they wouldn't give it to enslaved Africans because they kind of knew, because the tradition that was kind of handed down to them did have baptism as changing a person's social relation with their neighbor, okay? It's fascinating to see the American sort of kind of riff on this, you know, that them re-engineering things in such a way that it stripped that away. And I think in many ways, I think we're kind of living with that today, the doctrine of spirituality of the church, the way in which we do Christianity in such a way that it kind of says, hey, look, our faith commitments don't really touch our social relationship. And the moment that you began to bring that into the conversation, we're going to say that you're doing something that's aberrant to Christianity. We're going to say that you're doing something that's you're preaching a social gospel. You're doing something that's foreign to what it means to live the Christian life.
Can I toss just like two court cases for people to look up? Because I think that sometimes, especially when we are like have talked about this a lot, that we use language that people don't understand. So I'm thinking about, just for people who listen to this and want to Google it, you can look at Ozawa versus the United States in 1922, and you can look at the United States, and forgive me if I pronounce this wrong, United States versus Bhagat Singh Thein in 1923. One was a Japanese man who had fair skin and wanted to be categorized as white so that he could then be naturalized. And he was denied citizenship because they said, no, even if you're fair skinned, you don't get to be a part of that category. The second one was, according to the racial science at the time, Indian had some link to Caucasian. And so he says, well, then if I'm Indian, I'm kind of Caucasian, therefore, can I get into the category of white and get these privileges? And in both cases, that was denied. And so, no, when we're talking about white, we're talking about European white. And so when Micah starts talking about like the reality of whiteness, he's once again talking about like American legal precedent. It's amazing for us who are, you know, almost 100 years down the road from this to imagine to say, there were cases in the United States where they defined what white was. In the exact same way in the African-American context, they defined one drop. If you had one drop of blood, you were black. And so all of these legal cases create a perception. And so when you talk about like the host of these privileges that exist, we're talking about the long-term ramifications of these kinds of things. And so, yes, it does create, I think, in the Black, Asian American history, this sense of tension, because there is a sense of like fleeing us to get somewhere else.
Yeah, definitely.
And because the other category is, in America, it was a binary. You were either closer to being black, which meant bad, or closer to being white, which meant good.
Yeah, absolutely. And this brings up the issue of the myth of the model minority within the Asian American community, because, you know, in terms of the history of immigration in our country, you know, Asians as a whole were banned in 1917 from entering the U.S. And when re-entry was allowed again after World War II, it was, you know, it's called the brain drain from Asia because it was only the top doctors, the top lawyers, the top businessmen that were allowed to come to this country. And it was right at the height of the civil rights era that these Asians were coming in, and this myth of the model minority was created. And it was no accident, the timing for this. It was a myth created not because Asians are somehow some super intellectual people group, you know, smarter than anybody else, but it was to pit us directly against Asian American or African Americans, and we, to an extent, we bought into that, right? Because Asians started coming to this country and seeing the way that African Americans were treated and said, well, we don't want to be treated that way. We're going to, you know, acculturate, assimilate, try to become more white, and then we'll be treated better. And so it's layers of complication, and I'd love to hear you guys speak into that and the ways in which that has been internalized both within the Asian American and African American communities.
Asians are not the only immigrants that were confronted with the allure of assimilating into whiteness. Right. So even the Europeans, even different folks from European nationalities, the Irish, Italians, German, they have their own stories of assimilating into whiteness. Yeah. Right. Coming over here and basically realizing that there is a sort of social contract here that says that if you assimilate into whiteness, you will be afforded these social benefits. And if you do not, then you won't be afforded these social benefits because that's the caste system that we have here. So I think the difference is that that Asian people of Asian descent were not allowed to assimilate into whiteness, right? They were located in a different place on the caste system, but they could not they could sort of approach whiteness in some sense, but they never could fully assimilate into whiteness. And so You know, so they so they were in a just they're in a difficult situation there with that, because again, they're dealing with the that oppression, that disparity that is there. You know, it creates a tension with folks, other people in the on the caste system, because if you're lower on the caste system and you see somebody that so what whiteness does is it demands fidelity. Right. And it will say, look, we will afford you certain benefits if you also look down upon the people that we look down on. So there are benefits to that were afforded people if they did not associate with blacks. Right. There's this kind of this is not a situation of with an Asian person, but this is a situation with Dr. King's father, Daddy King. His autobiography talked about how he
somebody's getting a lot of text.
Oh man, I think that might be me. Somebody's just blowing me up. I'm sorry, y'all.
It's okay.
So Dr. King's father, Daddy King, tells a story in his autobiography of being a young boy and needing some glasses, and talking about how he went to a German a shop that was owned by a German man, and the German man, you know, was going to make his glasses, and then he was told by some neighbors that you don't need to serve blacks, you know, if you do, we're basically gonna boycott your shop, and you're gonna really you're gonna suffer here if you open your shop up to blacks. And so the German looks at Daddy King and says, I'm so sorry, I want to serve you, but if I do, my shop is going to suffer, you know. And so what ends up happening is, and I think you know, there are many immigrants who have that story, right, of having a certain kind of loyalty to the caste system demanded of them, so that they do have this kind of temptation to feed into that. And and of course that creates strife amongst folks who are being discriminated against, you know, people who are being oppressed and saying, hey, look, we're all in this together. Why are you treating me as subhuman? You know? So of course that's going to create strife amongst members with who are sort of in lower places in the caste system. So
it's really good, because what you're pointing to is that these sorts of issues of racial prejudice and racism are not isolated to a few individuals. And so our fight to deconstruct this isn't to just win over a few hearts. There's systems involved. Yeah. This is a systemic problem in our country. And I want to direct this question first to Jeff and then to everybody, because one of the problems that we hear when discussing racial prejudice and issues of racism in general is from Christians responding by saying, well, we just need to preach the gospel, right? And there's this pushback that if we try to go deeper into the conversation of anti-racism work or deconstructing racial prejudice, that somehow that's not kingdom work. We just need to preach the gospel. And so, Jeff, how would you respond to someone who says that, we're living in a unique time, the time of COVID-19, where we're seeing just this horrific rise in anti-Asian racism. It's May 13th, and this has been a tragic week for the Black community as well, in the wake of the killings of Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor, and these are real issues that we need to confront, or else this sort of horrific loss of life will continue. And so how do you respond to Christians who are saying, let's just preach the gospel?
Let me make a few prefatory comments, and then I'll launch into what I'll venture as an answer. The first is, I want to be incredibly gentle in answering this question, because I first encountered Jesus in a church where this just preach the gospel mentality was run of the mill. And I think a lot of people of color that I know have grown up in churches where just preach the gospel was kind of pushed in our faces, especially when we became concerned about social issues. I'm indebted to the faithful work of Sunday school teachers who said to me, just preach the gospel. And so if I start off by berating them for the truncated gospel that they gave me, they're going to just, you know, shrink up and not be able to listen to the next things I have to say. So I want to acknowledge my indebtedness to folks like that, while also complicating what they have done with me and to me. The second thing is, I want to acknowledge just how ubiquitous this sentiment, just preach the gospel, is. Earlier, when I caved into the notion of an American Christianity in that sort of general fashion, and everyone, especially Issam Akemeni, so helpfully complicated that, this is actually what I mean. This just preach the gospel mentality does not know boundaries that I'm aware of. It's absolutely true that Black Americans rescue theological anthropology. It's absolutely true that this all, the problem is tied to neoliberalism and the economics of capitalism. Absolutely true. But I've heard in Black, Brown, and Asian churches, just preach the gospel. So this, I would say, is one of the features of a wider American Christianity that gives rise to the same kind of binarism that Micah is talking about. That as long as we are talking between the poles of Black and white, Asian Americanness can either only be a wedge or it must disappear. As long as these features of a generalized American Christianity are at the forefront of how we understand theology and biblical studies, we're not having a conversation that will lead to racial unity and justice between Black Americans and Asian Americans. We're just not. So if I were to venture an answer, the first thing I would say is that forgetfulness, by telling me to just preach the gospel, despite the long history of difficulty between Asian Americans and Black Americans, forgetfulness dooms us to repeat mistakes. And I would say, secondly, that willful forgetfulness about what God has done in history, including the civil rights movement, that is a kind of intentional erasure. That's an unfaithfulness to the gospel itself. So forgetfulness. So I was in the same room as Stanley Hauerwas once, and he said, we have a word for forgetfulness here in the United States, and that word is money. And that hit me like a ton of bricks. And I think that highlights what Esau was saying earlier, that it's really neoliberal economics that tells us that when you reach a certain level of social mobility and a level of social capital, you can forget. That is one of our biggest dangers. And the Bible warns us about that more than almost anything.
I want to say something. I want to give Akemeni a chance to speak in case she wants to. I don't want to just jump in there and steal too much. Okay, so one of the things, and forgive me, I'm gonna like try this out, at least in my brain. It's something that I've been thinking about. I lived, and it relates to just preach the gospel, and to my mind, the limitations, the theological limitations of the term whiteness. And this is what I mean. If you wanna talk about the United States and how racial supremacy works in the United States, then whiteness as a theological category makes some sense because we're aspiring to this category, and there's the hierarchy that goes, you know, from whiteness down, I guess you would say, from as the way the narrative works. When I lived in Japan for 3 years, I was introduced to the Japan, Korea, China dynamic and all the racial issues in which we don't need to recount, right? And so I remember sitting there, and I was actually, for those of you who might know, I was in Okinawa, and Okinawans are a slightly different ethnic group than mainland people in Japan, and that was its own hierarchy. And the issue of how race functioned in that context, just in that those four groups of people, made me realize that what we were having in the United States as it relates to Black-white dynamics was a manifestation of something that you see everywhere. And then when I got to became friends with my African brothers and sisters, and my Uganda brothers and sisters, in their discussion of tribalism, I began to see the similar manifestation. And so what I think is that we need a theological category that doesn't simply center how this is played out in the United States as relates to the Black-white dynamic, but deals with this tendency in the human person, not simply to create biases, right? It's not the one-to-one tendency to create bias. I'm talking about the tendency in the human family to create systems of oppression rooted in racial hierarchy. And it's not, so I'm not saying that there's a heart problem that exists everywhere. What I'm saying is that in every part of the globe that you go to, you find someone who's looked at someone else. And sometimes the actual physical differences weren't exactly clear and then created a hierarchy. And we need to be able to say that the gospel doesn't simply encounter, doesn't simply push back on this one-to-one racism that we experience everywhere, but the gospel pushes on systems because of what it says about the worth of persons. And so what I want to say then is that the gospel doesn't simply deconstruct whiteness. That's how that happens in the United States. The gospel deconstructs systems of value rooted in anything. Actually, it just deconstructs systems of value that humans tend to create, and then we need to be able to bring that to the fore. And when you bring that to the fore in the United States, that's going to inevitably have to deal with the issues of how the enslavement of Black people and how that created an entire structure. But that's not the whole problem. It's an international story. And I think that sometimes it's helpful for us to not simply look at what is going on in the United States, but the global manifestation of this brokenness that manifests itself in culture after culture. And so I want to say that the gospel speaks to persons and systems that we can see throughout time and across culture.
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, what I would say about that, I mean, yeah, definitely, you're gonna see stratification all over the globe. I think the tendency to stratify, to differentiate, to put oneself up over another, we do have a category for that, and that's in a term, it's sin, right?
Yeah.
It seems so simplistic, but it's not. Sin is actually very complicated, highly adaptable. If you think about Cain and Abel, you go back to Genesis 4? Yeah, Genesis 4. You know, and you think about how the Bible talks about Cain's own jealousy, right, against Abel, right? He was jealous because Abel actually gave a good offering that was satisfying, you know, to God, whereas Cain didn't give his very best to God. And he was so burned with so much anger, so much jealousy, that he killed his own brother, you know, and God warned him, you know, that this sin, it wants to master you. It wants to rule over you. It's crouching at your door. It wants to devour you, but you must rule over it. And God didn't tell him that just to say that, is because he actually had the power to rule over it. But rather than rule over it, he was ruled by sin himself. And then that manifestation of that sin was that he ruled over his own brother and killed him, right? And so we see that sin manifesting its oppressive power. We see it manifesting itself within ourselves, right? And we see within all over the globe. So I believe we do need to be internationalists. I agree about that. And so we see that particularly with racism, prejudice, bigotry. We see that one, instead of mastering sin, you know, we want to master our brothers, we want to master our sisters, you know, we want to master people that have come from one blood, right? One blood, right? We all derive from Adam. And that's what the scriptures tell us there. So I would say in that, I don't know that we need another category, but I think we need to analyze it and exegete that and make it accessible, yeah, you know, to people so that they can enter in, you know, to that. And then you also mentioned, what was it? You mentioned, there was one more thing that you mentioned that I wanted to also, you know, tie in here, but maybe I'm forgetting it now. You said a lot of, you know, good things, but I want to talk about,
and forgive me. It's, yeah, like, if you don't deal with these issues, they always come back.
Sure.
So you can't just, and I think Jeff talked about forgetfulness. The problem is we don't actually forget. And COVID-19 is a perfect manifestation of it. There were all kinds of like Asian American racial stereotypes that kind of wax and wane with the economic and political, sure, realities of the country. And because they weren't actually dealt with, they exist as a latent fear that can then be activated during times of heightened stress. So whenever the country's under stress and we look for a scapegoat, because we didn't deal with the historic stereotypes around Asian Americans, it was easy to kind of grab that. And there was a sense in which we assumed that people just like outgrew, like, it's funny how people are non-evolutionary biologically, but they think that people can like evolve out of racism. So like, oh, we just don't do that sin anymore. We just evolved out of it. Like you're just born with the racial progress of your parents just downloaded into your DNA. Right. But the reality is, like the equality of persons must be relearned in every generation. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm saying is that like why just the gospel doesn't work is seen in the treatment of Asian Americans during COVID-19.
Right. Right. Yeah.
We went from pet to threat.
Very quickly, so, very quickly. And I think that's what's unique about America, which I think it is, that's why it is important that we center America, because Nobody does racism quite like America. I mean, we are the most racist country in the world.
We wrote the book on it.
I mean, Hitler got tips from America. I mean, seriously. I mean, like, these are just facts, you know? And so I think, and because it's so tied to capitalism, which requires, like, you know what I'm saying, which literally requires somebody to be, like, it requires sacrifice, right? It just does. It requires body, because it can be an idol, right? And we see this happening right now. The country's willing to sacrifice lives right now to get the economy started again, right? And so we see that it's tied to capitalism, and then it's tied to religion. In America, right? We see the power of the religious right that cropped up, you know, around the 70s or so, and has so much political power that they determine they have serious voting power in our election. You know, they're a main reason why we have the occupant in the White House that we have right now. And so I think as much as I believe in being an internationalist, I just think America just has something very uniquely different that's a phenomenon that's not happening quite in the same way that's happening in other places. There's a lot of places, other places are dealing with the vestiges of colonialism, right? That's actually how tribalism came to be. It exacerbated, you know, those tensions, whereas that wasn't something that was always occurring before colonialism began. So I just wanted to throw that in there to a little complicate some things, but.
You've got to. It's so complex. And I love everything that you guys are saying. It's something unique to our country. It's international. I want to push us to get a little uncomfortable here as we're coming to the end of our conversation, because I want us to talk about, you know, we are here, a group of Asian Americans and African American Christians. And we've been talking about this kind of from the 50,000 foot level, and I want to make it personal now, because for people who are watching, what we are wanting to encourage each other and those listening in is to now turn inward and to look into our own lives and how can we deconstruct racial prejudices. If you're Asian American, how do you deconstruct racial prejudices against African Americans? And if you're African American, how do you deconstruct racial prejudices against Asian Americans? And I wanted to start with Esau, if you don't mind. Would you be willing to share personally from your own life what that's looked like? Can we even map out steps? Like how does one do this personally?
So, I mean, this is one of those things where I'm just going to be completely 100. I was raised with, and I didn't even realize it until I got to college. I was just raised with anti-Asian American bias. It was just like in the water. Because we were told, this is my reception of the Black Consciousness Movement. It's not what everybody Black was saying. It's what they were saying in Huntsville, Alabama. That especially like the nail and the hair salons were always owned by Asian Americans, especially immigrants, and that this was seen as a manifestation of a lack of Black economic control. And so the way to have Black economic control was to run the Asian Americans out of the Black community. You see this exact thing, I think it's in Do the Right Thing, where there's the riot. If you haven't seen the movie, there's a riot at the end of the movie. We won't get into the whole thing. But the riot is burning down these businesses. It first burns down a white business across the street. It's a pizza parlor. And then they come to, I think it's a Korean-owned store. And the Korean man is out there trying to defend his store from these Black rioters. And the Korean man says, "I'm Black." And this is a really poignant scene, because the Black guy goes, "You're not Black." And so the real question I think that Spike Lee is asking, Spike Lee is actually getting to the middle of this, the middle minority myth, right? That what's actually happening is the Korean American person who's there is himself a victim of discrimination because of he has broken English, and for a variety of other reasons, he's receiving persecution from the majority culture, but he's also the object of scorn in the African American context. And so that building is actually not burned down and do the right thing, and they go somewhere else. But what I'm saying is there was at least a form of like of African American consciousness where I didn't understand or even consider what the immigrant experience was like for someone who wasn't me. And so part of my own consciousness was saying, I don't have to see an immigrant who's just trying to make his way in the United States as my enemy. And I was taught to see him as my enemy. So that's the first thing. The other one was the academic achievement that was put in the African-American context. Like, look, you should be like these people who are doing well. And so there's this sense of resentment. And so what I want to say is part of my own journey was rejecting the competition and understanding the complexities of what was happening with the immigrant experience in the United States. And so what I want to say is that like Black consciousness doesn't have to be anti-Asian. And that is something that I want to be able to say. So you can say both things. It needs to be Black businesses and Asian businesses. Like these two things, there's not a limit. There's not in that sense, like there's it can be really easy to say that if there's 100% of the economy, and then the black people and the Asian people can like fight over the 10%, instead of looking at the systems of oppression that lead us into these same mm-hmm. impoverished communities and working together to create a solution. Mm-hmm. And so part of it for me was just owning that history mm-hmm. of like how Black consciousness sometimes talks about Asian American stuff. And even to be honest, the fetishization, can you say that word? The kind of Asianness, like the foreign woman, and like and all of that stuff that exists, it's just stuff that is uncritically accepted. And so it's this, this is the last example. One of the things you do when you're Black in the South, at least I think it is, you ask people where they're from because you're trying to find their relatives. So when Micah says, I'm from Tennessee, I say, oh, who are your people in Tennessee? So I can figure if we related, because all Black people think we're related. So I was talking to an Asian American student, and I asked him, he came to my office, and I said to him, like, where are you from? And when I was thinking of it, I was thinking of it from the Southern context of what part of the United States are you from so I can see where you are. And he initially, I'm like, what's the problem? And he says, do you mean where am I from in the United States? I said, yeah, like, what else would you mean? And the reason I tell that story is that it was me normalizing my perception of how location works in culture and not thinking about how he thinks about location and identity, given the ways in which Asianness is forever foreign, is made forever foreign. And so part of my own spiritual journey is learning to think through the American experience as much as possible from how my Asian American brothers and sisters might be experiencing it, and not simply normalizing Blackness and making everybody adjust to it.
I would say that I confess some of these things on Truth Table, but I want to take it in a different direction. I think it's hard to love a people that you don't know, and what I mean by that is that we have to take the time to actually learn about the history of Asian Americans in this country, what their current plight is, what their past plight is, what does the future hold for them? I think if we don't care, then we don't love. Like, you know what I'm saying? And that's void of love, I think. And so I think part of what that looks like is educating ourselves on that, on these things. So PBS has this special right now. I think it's a three-part special on Asian. Oh, five. Great. All right. Of Asian American like history in this country. And so I was so excited to see the ads for it, and I'm looking forward to watching it, because there's so much I just don't know, to be quite honest, about Asian American history, you know, in this country. And so so I think part of that is learning historical things like that, and even just watching, I know it seems very basic, but watching movies, you know, that some Asian American or Asian directors, whether they be American or not, learning about their culture, being immersed in their culture, not just going for just the most, the commercial ones that we know, you know, I won't name what it is, but, but, you know, like actually digging to learn, you know, and to see and see like, oh, okay, what are the questions that they're asking? What are the questions that they're grappling with in their culture, in their society? What are the expectations in their family? What does that look like? How does that connect to my own experience? Right, as a Black woman in America. And so I think just beginning to broaden even just our own appetite, you know, for learning about other cultures, particularly Asian culture, is how we can begin to dispel the ignorance, whether it's intentional or not, and to begin to really have, humanize, you know, and see Asian Americans as our brothers and sisters, as you all are. So I think seeing, watching, reading, of course, those I think are some tangible ways that we can, you know, just begin to learn more about your culture.
I appreciate that so much. And I'm going to go next so that Micah can have the last word on this question. Just to kind of tell a little bit of my, just a quick snapshot of my story. I grew up with as many anti-Black influences and messages as a lot of folks who grew up in the suburbs of Oklahoma do. So I'm from the suburbs of Tulsa, Oklahoma. I spent my first 10 years in a rural part of America, rural Oklahoma, population 2000, that kind of a place. So, you know, as Southern nice as everyone was, I grew up with just as many anti-Black messages. At the same time, I internalized messages about the uniqueness and giftedness of being Taiwanese American. So, you know, in critical race theory, we talk about white over color hierarchy, but for me growing up, it was being Taiwanese versus everybody else. So I had my own kind of supremacy to deal with there. You know, we can talk later on after the call about whether to call that racism or not, but I know what it was for me. It was a pejorative view of everyone else. And I didn't shed that until lamentably late in my life. And I deal with the fallout of that every day of my life. And I work to repent of that with Jesus and before the body of Christ all the time. The first thing that I had to do was just acknowledge that I was a part of the problem because of what I had internalized. And whether or not I'm culpable, I am responsible. And I had to be responsible to re-educate myself, to unlearn some things, and to work in new ways. And I would say that right now, as we see so many incidents of anti-Asian racism, this is the best time for Asian Americans to begin to shed their anti-Blackness, because and this is why I think the work of the Asian American Christian Collaborative is so important. What we're facing now, two things. Number one, it's not new for Asian Americans. Connect with the story of resistance and struggle that we've had before. But as you do that, remember that this is not new for the United States, that the Black intellectual tradition is built on the kind of resistance from which we need to be learning. The resources that we have now are critical for us to take on board. But while we do that, this is a cautionary tale that I think is important for us. It's, and I've said this before in this call, to reject the Black-white binary. It's so damaging to Asian Americans. It fetishizes not just Blackness and not just Black struggle, but it fetishizes Asian Americans as well. So there's two problems with the binary. You cannot fetishize Blackness and the Black struggle as an Asian American. And number two, you cannot win by cozying up to whiteness. That does nothing for you. So to shed yourself of anti-Blackness and to engage in resistance for racial justice means to learn something new about being Asian American. And that has been taken from us in so many ways by so many of the forces to relearn our history. And that's why Akemeni's plug for this documentary series, so important to learn our story. Even if you immigrated after 1965 or your parents did, and you're somewhat disconnected from all the struggle, the history of struggle from 1882 on, there's still something to learn because, as has been said in this call, we don't forget this racial narrative. And it will be played again and again. Even if you came after 1965, after the civil rights legislation was enacted, we still face the perpetual foreigner and yellow peril stereotypes from 1882, even if you don't feel that you do. So there's a lot of learning for us to do.
Yeah, that's that. All is so great. I really appreciate everything that's been shared up to this point. I just want to share a little bit about my personal story with this. For me, it's really had to do with shedding the scarcity mentality, the idea that you know, justice is a zero sum game. Sort of, you know, if one group is blessed, then somehow I'm diminished. You know, and oftentimes when you are finding yourself in a situation of economic disparity, you can look at another group and you can feel like, well, if this group gets anything, then somehow that's taken away from me. I'll say this. I'll just be honest with you. I have one of my most painful experiences with racism leveled against me was when I actually found myself standing up for the Asian community. And I was actually the target of a whole lot of Black folks, you know, who looked at me like a sellout because I had the gall to actually suggest that, you know, Christians should actually stand up and advocate for our Asian and Asian American neighbors in the midst of all the discrimination, the recent discrimination that was happening, that has been happening against them. And especially when it came to how people just decided to stay away from Asian and Asian American businesses, I kind of made it my business to say, hey, look, I'm going to go to these businesses. I'm going to show our neighbors that we are in this together, and I'm going to advocate, and I'm going to invite others to do that. And when I did that in a public way, my Twitter blew up with all kinds of racial epithets coming my way from Black people, you know, and that was a really difficult experience. But what I recognized in that situation was that there are folks who, again, had that kind of scarcity mentality, the sense of look, if you advocate for another group, then you're being disloyal to our group. More justice for them means less justice for us. And I think we've got to encourage one another that that justice is not a zero-sum game, that that we need to weep with those who weep, and we need to rejoice with those who rejoice. And we've got to do it across ethnic lines. We've got to deliberately do it across the ethnic lines. And that doesn't mean that when we do so, we're being disloyal to our own struggle. We need to learn more about the struggle of our own people so that we can be better equipped to love our neighbors well and empathize with what they're going through. That's part of why I did what I did. I said, look, if anybody knows what it's like to be discriminated against, it's Black folk. And so I know the pain that my Asian brothers and sisters are going through. I deal with this regularly. And so I'm going to go and I'm going to empathize. And I'm going to say to them, hey, we're in this together. Let's stand with each other, you know? So I would just encourage everybody to, again, learn your own history. It has been said before, weep with those who weep. Deliberately do it across ethnic lines. Because that's not happening in our society, you know. Let's do that across, let's be conspicuous and do that across the ethnic lines. Let's rejoice with those who rejoice. When we see, when we see Asian, Asian American filmmakers and artists and directors and, you know, being celebrated, let's rejoice. You know, let's rejoice in the same way that we would want them to rejoice with us. And let's join together, and let's be conspicuous in that. And let's be real practical in these things. Let's not just talk about it, but let's be about it.
Yeah. That's so good. Thank you, Mike, and all of you guys for your vulnerability and honesty. And I'm grateful for the ways in which that you guys, Esau, Kamini, Micah, that you have stood in solidarity with the Asian American community. That means so much to us. And I want to add one more question that I didn't mention to you guys before, but I think the more I heard you guys talking about these things, about Akemni, you know, the educational piece, and you know, the forgive learning to deconstruct those sort of racial ideologies in our own lives, the forgiveness piece, because there's also the healing processes that need to take place. This is something that's not just for individual followers of Jesus, but for something that the church needs to be actively participating in. And you know, it's good. It's not wrong for churches to speak up or for pastors to speak up in the wake of a horrific tragedy. They should. And but that's kind of the bare minimum, right? Like, how do we turn this into a whole way life discipleship and ministry and a way of doing church for Asian American churches and African American churches or multicultural churches in general? How do we turn this into something that we don't just do when a tragedy hits, but that we're doing this holistically in all way of life sort of thing?
I'll take a stab at that. I want to say a couple of things about the different kinds of church communities and the different kinds of courage that is needed. There's one way of talking about this. We say, well, the solution is let's just all create multi-ethnic churches so we're all smashed together. And then that deals with the issue of racism and systemic injustice. I don't think that's always the solution. I think that sometimes majority Black churches, majority Korean church, majority Chinese churches are spaces where for the first time, those people get a chance to develop as leaders, grow, have a say in their own governance. And then we know that most of the time when you create multi-ethnic churches, it just ends up encoding the majority culture and including the ethnic minorities there. So I want to say that if you're looking at ethnic-specific churches, even in that context, it's very important for those pastors to still address issues of race and class, because that might be the one place where that can be explored. So as an African-American, if you're in an African-American church context, yes, you're dealing with particular issues that you're facing for your community, but you can begin to educate your community about ways to have cooperation. If you're in a multi-ethnic church, you have to ask yourself, is this multi-ethnic church encoding the majority white culture and smashing down Black and Asian American identity? And how can I be intentional about making space for these things in my church so that everybody is learning to be cruciform in their sacrifices for the sake of unity? And so I want to say then is that regardless, that kind of courage is going to look different in different churches. So I don't know if there's one size that fits all. But I would say that you can look around in your context and say, what does the gospel and the Christian tradition require of me in this context? And if you're in a majority, like Asian American context, majority Korean church, it might be your job to talk about anti-Blackness, because they may never invite me to their church to talk about anti-Blackness. So you need to stand up from the pulpit and say, if this is your problem, in our context, this idea of implicit anti-Blackness that exists in the Korean context or the Chinese-American context needs to be dealt with, and it needs to be exegeted out of people and discipled out of them, because it's a place where I can't go. So I want to say then, be courageous, but be courageous in a way that's actually courageous in your context. It's not courageous to be like pro-Black when you got all kinds of Black people around you, right? What are you doing? And so use courage and work for the kind of change your community needs to see, even if it costs you something. And it always costs you something to be faithful to the gospel. And if it doesn't cost you something, then you're probably not being faithful.
And I just say, it's in the book. It's all there. I don't think we often have to go far. Now, obviously, I'm a public theologian, so I believe in engaging with different disciplines, you know, so I'm not opposed to that. But I don't think we have to go far. It's in the text. It's in here. You know, it's here from Genesis to Revelation. You see, you see that certification. You see the differentiation. It's all in there if one has eyes to see it. And you can pull out those implications and make them very accessible for anybody in the congregation to be able to apprehend it and grasp it and hopefully run with it, right? And then you can begin to, you know, talk nuts and bolts about what this looks like when you're walking with somebody, discipling somebody, challenging them when they say something that is bigoted and prejudice. I just had to do that a couple weeks ago with a family member, you know, and like, that's not right. Like, you know, that God's not pleased by that. And these are the reasons why. So I would say, yeah, I would say it's in the text. So I don't think you don't have to go very far to go and figure out, first should I bring in and pull in here to talk about anti-blackness? It's in here in the text. And if you can exegete that text well, then you should be able to bring out those implications and those practical takeaways for people, particularly given the climate that we're in. This is everywhere. there's a lot of hatred, you know, going around, a lot of lovelessness, you know, and a lot of polarization, you know, so there's so many ways, you know, to talk about this from at the church, in the church.
If I could, I would just add this, if you are a pastor, or a public theologian, or just, you know, just a faithful Christian that wants to know more about God's word, I would say, you know, yes, absolutely. Dig into the text, dig into the scripture. Also read the Bible along with Asian and Asian American commentators and Christians and theologians, and listen to them. And because, it's really important. So the Catholicity of the church, the fact that we are people that are comprised of people from every tribe and nation and tongue, that's really important. You know, the Lord has not given any one particular ethnic group all the perspective on the scriptures. And all the wisdom, but he has spread it out amongst the people from every tribe and nation and tongue. We have a lot to learn from our Asian, Asian American brothers and sisters about what the scriptures have to say and how they have applied it in their particular situation. And we can see the glory of Christ at work amongst them, and we can celebrate that. And that has something to teach us, as well as what the Lord has done in our midst as well. So that's just a word of advice I would give to folks as well.
I love everything so far. I'm coming at this from a position in which my job is to exercise theological leadership. I've been thinking about that since I was a pastor in the church. And now that's my actual job. I think I want to say a couple things. I stand in the Reformed tradition, which is a strange fit, actually, I think for a lot of us, for what the Reformed tradition has meant in terms of racial justice and racial injustice, actually. So I'm encouraged to see some folks here who are doing what they're doing, especially because it can be so difficult in some of the spaces where we find ourselves. But theological leadership in spaces that are foreign to the kind of race-conscious reading of the Bible that Akemene was talking about, The call for folks, for pastors, for readers of the Bible, is to access the kind of theological leadership that will lead you to that race-conscious reading of the scripture. Because to whitewash everything as you read the scripture makes you a tomb of a certain kind. And I can't tell you how many times pastors have asked me to consult for free on what to do with their next hire, what to do with their strategy for racial reconciliation, what to do with the neighborhood across the tracks, all that kind of stuff. And it drives me a little bit crazy, because y'all need to pay somebody to do that. That's an area of expertise that you need desperately, and that people have worked hard, studied hard, paid a lot of money to gain some skills in. So to exercise theological leadership in your context means to treat this like you would any other kind of professional consultation. So that you can learn, especially if you don't yet know how, to identify the community cultural wealth and spiritual capital in other communities and other communities of faith. So just a quick book plug, Robert Chow Romero's book, Brown Church, is coming out. He utilizes this framework of spiritual capital because so often we think about other communities as predominantly communities of deficit, that I don't have anything to learn from them, and that's why I've got to go do mission to them. But really what we need is a kind of theological leadership that says, I need to submit myself to these folks and learn at their feet, because they bring something that God has given them. Even God has given them these things through the struggle of racialization and racial injustice. And that's something that I can't learn without them. And that's going to take a kind of humility and leadership that we have not yet seen.
Amen. Well, thank you all so much for this thought-provoking conversation. This is a much needed and timely topic for Christians within the Asian American and African American communities to be addressing. And I hope that this segment in particular will equip and empower both individual followers of Jesus to begin incorporating this type of head-on confrontation of racial prejudices and racism in their own personal lives and within every level of leadership, ministry, and discipleship pathway in the church. And so for our listeners, we hope that you've been encouraged, as I have been, by this conversation. And I hope that you'll stay tuned for part 3 of the series, which will now turn to pursuing paths of healing and solidarity.